My name is Bill Erbrock. I'm from the Religious Studies Department at the University of Wisconsin in Oshkosh. And this week we're doing a series of five studies that are centering around a book by Phyllis Trible, who teaches at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. The book is entitled Texts of Terror, Literary Feminist Readings of Biblical Narratives. And if you would like to purchase a copy of the book, they are available in the bookstore. We will be following her book chapter by chapter in the subsequent 4 days this week. And we'll be dealing with four women in the Old Testament about whom terrible stories are told. Women who were abused, and women whom Phyllis Trible would like to memorialize and raise into our conscience. They are Hagar, the Egyptian slave girl, who belonged to Abraham and Sarah. The second woman is Tamar, the daughter of David, who was raped by her half-brother, Amnon. The third woman is a woman who never even gets a name in the Old Testament. She's the unnamed concubine of the Levite, who was raped to death. And the fourth woman is the daughter of the great warrior Jephthah, who was offered up by her father as a sacrifice to God. I chose this book and these readings as a follow-up to some studies that we did last week, led by Trible, on God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality. And if there are any of you that are staying a long time, we're going to be doing those again next week. But I chose them also because of the summer theme. Under the shadow of God's wings. That image is a protective image in some ways, under the shadow of God's wings. We talked about this at some length in our sessions last week. Many people had a picture of God as a great protecting eagle, or that New Testament image of God like a mother hen gathering the chicks together. But there's also a darker side to that image. If you were a little rabbit or a ground squirrel or a mouse and you suddenly found yourself under the shadow of an eagle's wings or an owl's wings, I don't know whether you would feel that you were in a terribly protected state. And so I've used as a theme for these studies this week, suffering under the shadow, and I want to talk today about images of God suffering. As it turns out, serendipitously, it's a theme that's going to be sounded all week in the village. It was sounded yesterday in Matins and Eucharist. You'll remember that one of our readings was from Paul, and that very striking assurance that he received that my strength is made perfect in weakness. And as it turns out, several of the sessions at Holden this week are going to be dealing with suffering and with healing. It's going to be coming up over and over. Evidently, the question isn't whether or not we must suffer, whether or not, you see. And the question isn't whether or not we may avoid suffering. As we mature, we, you know, very soon for some of us, somewhat later for others of us, finally come to see the obvious that we are all going to suffer to a greater or a lesser extent. And so the question isn't whether we do or don't suffer, whether we may or may not avoid it, but the question is whether we can suffer well. And the question also, it seems to me, is whether we can become empowered to such an extent that while we ourselves are suffering well, we can also enter into solidarity creatively with the suffering of others. And perhaps we also need to become more aware of those who suffer even now on our behalf. If it's true that humanity redeemed bears the image of God, One of the questions I always like to ask myself is, where is the suffering of God most poignantly revealed to us today? And it's a question I would put to you right now. Where in the world do you today perceive images of God suffering? Two people have immediately answered Ethiopia. Can you explain what you mean by that?
The hollowed look of the eyes, or, I don't know, just a gawk. Yes.
Are these pictures you've seen on your TV screen? And
possibly, I would say, yes.
Let's say part, that's a fair way to say that those who are hungry and suffering in Ethiopia, because there's another group who are living high on the land, I assume, so it's the images we have from television and from what we read, and I think it's the failure, the failure to respond in spite of that. I don't know if any of you saw the 60 Minutes when that Monsignor, Catholic Monsignor, was on and was pointing out this child starving to death. Said, "Do you really believe that that child cares? Is a communist? Or is a communist? And do you really think that child has any conception of political ramifications of that starvation?" And I think that's where we have to start responding. We've got to get out of this idea. If someone's hungry, we ought to feed them, as the Lord Himself did. But I see that's what bothers me. But then it goes to South Africa,
all right,
places around the world, in a different way. I mean, a different kind of. God is suffering over.
All right. So God is suffering in the hungry, in Ethiopia, in the abandoned, and the question and the response here also, I'm repeating this just in case the tape didn't get it all, that where you see children, for example, with that look, you wonder how it is that they suffer because they're communists.
Yeah, right.
Yes, right.
It's just another,
another response now.
I would say God is suffering wherever humanity cannot live as fully as they're meant to live, whether it's because of lack of food, political access, so that they can make their own rules of how they live. If they don't have adequate schooling, because illiteracy can make you not fully human. Anything where that keeps you from being fully human, I would assume God would be suffering because you are not living in your fullness.
Okay, the response was wherever human beings haven't attained fullness or are striving for fullness and are finding all kinds of obstacles in the way, there God suffers. Another response.
You see, I'm trying to figure out how to put this, and it sort of follows on that one, but when you put out the question, the first thing I thought about were just people in the city, and not the ones who are down on Skid Row, or often they're freer than the rest of us, but rather just the whole kind of attitude in our culture that is completely constrained either by materialism or success orientation. And I think God suffers wherever people are unwilling to either face their own suffering, unwilling to be involved with people, unwilling to look at God. Am I making sense?
Evidently you are, because there are a lot of nods.
What? Okay, there's sort of a cultural malaise and numbness in our society, especially among the haves.
All right. A sort of cultural malaise among the haves.
And I think God suffers with that.
And God suffers through that. Dick Mayer was saying this morning that our inability to admit that we may fail. And so we suffer when we're unable to fail. There's a special kind of suffering. There's a suffering evidently in failure, but I think Dick was suggesting perhaps there's an even worse or second degree of suffering or a super added level when you're unable to fail. Because failure is going to come inevitably anyway. Yes, a follow-up.
I think that, I think like with the starving in Ethiopia, it's easy to say God suffers with that. But to me, I guess maybe the way to say that would be God weeps with those people and is probably more present in Ethiopia than is possible in an urban situation in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But really suffers for the people who can't see their suffering.
All right. God suffers where people don't even realize
don't really,
the suffering they're in.
Pull out Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
strikes me that...
Another response, please.
Strikes me, dovetailing on that, that God suffers not only with the people in the city, but the people in this nation because of the patterns of our consumption, which affect people in third world countries and in Ethiopia, et cetera, et cetera. The kinds of values that we have where we place money and how we use, abuse resources.
The use and abuse of resources is a signal or a sign or an image of the suffering of God.
And I think only the American sense that with the country also.
Do you have images of God suffering that are close to home to you?
I think schools, sometimes for children. And since that's where I see a lot of people are, they always have, if we're dealing with area failures, in other words, that sometimes I think we as educators and teachers create the environment of failure among children. I think many of us really in the field of education that all that potential that we tamper with.
All right, the way we tamper with human potential. In other words, all those possibilities for creativity, and so much of our teaching actually thwarts it. So that instead of suffering the little children, we make the little children suffer.
Other parts, of course, are beautiful too.
And the super added violence in some of our schools and cities, for example. And obviously the schools are there reflecting a cultural milieu in which a lot of these children come to the schools underfed to begin with. They come from families that have been broken for one or another reason to begin with. They find no other ways of discovering solidarity except in violence. Yes, here.
I think God suffers in our interpersonal relationships when we fail to listen to those around us. I think he suffers when our interpersonal relationships, when we refuse or are unable to be the body of Christ to each other.
All right, a suffering in interpersonal relationship when we either are unable to be what we maybe would like to be, or when we refuse to be what we know we're called to be. Something like the good that I would, I don't do, and just what I really feel I shouldn't do is what I end up doing the most. Is that an accurate reflection of what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah.
Someone here.
I think going back to, say, post-World War II, where the availability of funds, as far as the GIs as an example, became more and more prevalent for college and university training. And then young men and young women going to school, and they weren't ready for it, and they would fail. There's real suffering in that case, and that still happens.
Yes, people who've been wrenched out of what we would call the more normal ways of living and have been, you know, put into sort of a never-never land. When you go into the service, in a way, you become a different kind of a person. And there are rituals, supposedly, on both ends. It becomes sort of a hiatus in your life, and then trying to somehow get back into the society, and whether or not there are funds ready for education. I suppose there's a powerful image of that today, and here we are a decade since Vietnam, and the walking dead of Vietnam that are just all over this country yet. You know, some of them not walking. I believe the statistics are that now there have been more of our warriors who have killed themselves since coming back than died in Vietnam. I think that's correct. There are more suicides now. What about all the children, half-breeds in Vietnam that no one wants to accept, that were fathered by GIs? There's a class that Walter Capps, who has been at Holden before, is currently teaching at University of California in Santa Barbara, And it's about the Vietnam experience and its religious implications. And he's been getting an enormous enrollment in that class. It's something like 800 or 900 people. Mm-hmm. And Walter was at our university shortly before we came to Holden to have a consultation with the members of our department about our program. And he was sharing to us some of the experiences that have come out of that class. And one day, you know, and this happens almost every day, but one day, I guess a young man came up towards the end of the class, and he took the microphone, because it's such a huge class, Dr. Capps has to use a microphone every day, and he said, I've got to tell you something that's been on my mind. And I guess he just started talking very ramblingly and you know, with great difficulty at the beginning, and soon he was just going on and on about these awful experiences he had in Vietnam, well beyond the end of the class time, you know. And when it was finally over, he apologized for what he had said. He apologized for the awful things he had done to people in Vietnam. He said, I'm not that kind of a person, but I ended up doing these atrocious sorts of things. And I guess when he was finished, this whole audience, you know, like a person, rose up for a standing ovation to this young man. And 10 years for him to tell his story and to have a group of people accept him. You know, think of the moment of healing there, but the suffering that he's carried. And of course, there are all kinds who haven't told their stories yet. All of these young men that are living up in the hills now in Idaho and elsewhere, taken to the woods and gone into isolation or whatever, roving around with their shotguns. Story that I remember of a young man in Pennsylvania where I was teaching before I went to Wisconsin. And he took my class purposely because I had a beard. And he had heard that I had opposed the war in Vietnam. And he was not a Green Beret, but he had been in special service, whatever they call it. Special what? Special forces or whatever. But he had gotten very special training. And so he came to the class because he wanted to see how he could oppose me. And within a couple of weeks, he came up and apologized to me because of the way he enrolled. He said, I'm sorry. I really didn't want to take it for a class. I came in here to make trouble for you. And I see that it hasn't turned out this way. And I wanted to tell you this. But he said, I need to tell you a story. And the story was that he had almost killed his wife one night in bed because she had turned around and touched him in the wrong way. Thank you, sir.
I know that my husband, after he was out of the service, he was in the airport, and I know he used to tell us after we were first married, he says, if it's dark at night, he says, be very quiet, don't touch me because I might hit you.
Yeah. Well, this young man had almost strangled his wife in bed. And I guess she called out his name, and he woke up. Because he was trained to just react on a split second. Yes. Yeah. And my wife Barb and I have a very good friend in Oshkosh. He's now graduated from the university, and he's working in TV up at Green Bay. But very gentle young man, extremely gentle young man. I'd like to say his name and affirm it. His name is Del Cannon. And he was also trained in a lot of these self-protection techniques. A very committed Christian young man also. And he told me when he first took one of my classes, he ended up taking several and he became a friend of ours. He house sat for us one summer. He said, now Bill, never tap me on the back if you want to surprise me and say hello. He said, I'm still learning how to react to that. And he told all of his roommates how if anything ever happened that they needed to awake him in an emergency or anything, or never to fool around with him at night if he was sleeping and play a joke and come up and tap him on the shoulder or anything like that. They were supposed to make some noise before they first came into the room.
Someone told me.
I mean, that's how he had, you know, and he was still suffering this. Mm-hmm. Because he knew that he couldn't make many of these normal responses to people. And I felt in him, you know, the suffering of the Eternal One.
Someone said the killing, I don't know, some the killing feels at one of the few words that said, just recently we're talking about some relation to suffering here, maybe it was last week, and said that, I mean, just a small measure of the,
yes.
The atrocity and the tragedy
of the situation. The gentleman is talking about the film, The Killing Fields. What about illness? Are there any who have been close to you who have, where you've seen the, you know, God imaged in the way they have suffered with an illness? Yes?
My mother is currently suffering with cancer. She's always been going on probably 3 or 4 years now. It's starting, I don't know when the end is coming, but she's been a real, it's been real interesting for our family to see her strength in meeting the suffering, even though it's awful and she's in pain all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That she is actually a source of strength for us,
yes,
in her suffering.
Yes, your mother has borne her suffering in such a way. And it seems to me that there, you know, it doesn't always have to be real patient suffering. Sometimes we tend to think, well, you know, you suffer well when you're real patient. If you get angry, then you're not suffering well. Well, I'm sure this is going to come up in Dick Meyer's Psalms classes, that he's already told us this morning he's going to do something with the laments. And, I mean, the lamenters are anything but patient. I mean, and if you read the book of Job, you know, that old statement that the patience of Job, if ever there's a caricature of a person, it's to talk about the patience of Job. What we really ought to talk about is the rage of Job. His situation was such that wherever he turned, he just couldn't find the answers. He couldn't put it together. It never fit. And it filled him with such frustration, such anger, such rage. And he just shook his hand at the Almighty. The reason he was so enraged is because he was convinced that there was an Almighty. I guess you don't get quite as enraged if you're not convinced of that. But if there's supposed to be a caring Almighty One there, then you really get enraged. I'm reminded of something else. It appears to me that one place very powerfully where the suffering of God has been imaged for us in our time is in, you know, the systematic destruction of people in the Second World War. Gypsies and, quote, communists, all those second-class citizens who were the Slavic peoples. You know, the master race ideology was not only against the Jews. The next ones to go were going to be the Slavs. And many of the Slavs, in my opinion, were already being, you know, they were being used to help round up the Jews, not knowing that they would be the next ones. Because there, it wasn't just the Germans, right, who were trying to get rid of the Jews. I mean, that's an old European widespread program. And it was greatly helped by, you know, certain aberrations of Christian teaching about his blood be on us and our children. And you take the children to mean for all generations, now and forever, Selah. How could anyone ever make such a decision for all generations? It seems to me there's an... And if you read some of Elie Wiesel's books, particularly Night, and that poignant story of this young boy taken to the concentration camp, seeing his family decimated, and that difficult time he had when his father was suffering and finally died, and that... Then that climactic day when the guards made an example of this young boy and hanged him and made everyone in the concentration camp walk by and witness the hanging. And he said, that day God died for me. That day God died. Someone behind him said, where is God? And another person next door said, he's hanging right there. And here's this teenage boy witnessing all of this and then having to live after it.
Yes.
You know, who has the more difficult situation? The ones who die soon are the ones who have to live. Or if you saw that movie, Sophie's Choice, what kind of a choice was that she had? That was no choice at all. That was damnation. So I guess we don't have to look real far to see images of God suffering in our world. Paul, please.
Another example would be the film shown earlier this year on Raoul
Wallenberg.
Raoul Wallenberg. And that was very a moving thing, the work that he did.
Yeah. Up here.
Yeah, another important spot is in terms of domestic violence and rape and relationships of men and women and families together that are out of balance and abusive, and I think God suffers very much with that, as does our whole culture.
And in fact, we even had someone here telling a story last week to us. And part of the healing process was the ability of the Andersons to share that story. And it wasn't only the wife who suffered, it was the husband who suffered as well. We're talking about domestic abuse of all sort and abuse not only within families but of those invading families and abusing persons. There's a very striking collection in the library here at Holden, and I put it before you for your reading sometime this week or next week or the next time you're up here. Otherwise, look for it when you get back home. It's the Lutheran World Federation report. It's report number 19 and 20, a combined report published in February of this year, 1985, and it's the report of the proceedings of the 7th Assembly of the LWF at Budapest last year, 1984. The assembly was entitled In Christ, Hope for the World. And there are some voices that I heard in this report that speak for God's suffering. And I wanted to just share a couple of them with you to, so that you have a sense of some of the pain and suffering that was shared at the LWF assembly. Here's a statement by T. Simon Farisani. He's dean of one of the circuits of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Southern Africa. He's a black person. And he says, "We thank God for Christ. He was committed and involved. Had he remained in heaven as crown prince, basking in the music of the angels, he would still be studying recommendations by Michael and Gabriel, perhaps even counter-recommendations from the fallen angels, pleading the complexity and complications of the tension between East and West, North and South, small and big apartheid, etc. And then a vote would follow. Maybe a simple majority or a two-thirds majority. Matter would be shelved. Refer back to the Holy Spirit. Report it back to Christ. Bring further recommendations to the Father, who would then take the matter back to the full council to reconsider the whole matter in the light of latest developments, and then take into account the outcome of possible meetings scheduled for next year, if it doesn't rain." Had Christ operated this way from heaven, he would probably still be there today, and you and I would all be assembled in hell with not the slightest peace and hope. See, the suffering, and you and I have felt this, I'm sure all of us who've been in committees, even when we deal with rather small and irrelevant problems, you know, the frustration and suffering we feel when we can't come to some decision and action. But when it comes to these sorts of matters, of life and death and discrimination against whole populations, the pain that this man is speaking here, the suffering out of which he must be speaking. "Christ calls upon this assembly," he goes on, "and I am his prophet, to take the heavy cross, to go the narrow path, to follow the via dolorosa of hope, peace, and security in Christ, and to dismantle the infamous old lie that East and West, North and South are created to destroy one another. Love is the cornerstone of peace, and God is love itself. It is cheap talk to speak of one's love of God when one doesn't love one's fellow human being. It is cheap to love God. After all, God isn't a communist or a socialist," Westerners would say. We love everybody else but them. For the Easterners, God is also easy to love. He certainly isn't a capitalist. And so it's expedient and convenient to love God. He certainly isn't black. He certainly isn't poor. He certainly doesn't disturb me at lunch or dinner. I don't see him on TV pleading for a daily dollar or for his daily bread from Ethiopian soil. Well, I think Farzani maybe would have been delighted at the solidarity in this group this morning, because some of us have seen God there in those places. Here's a statement from Margareta Grapalanz. I hope that's a correct pronunciation. She is Deputy General Secretary of the International Center of the Swedish Labor Movement, and she's also a member of the Church of Sweden. And she has a section in here talking on hope for humankind and third world people. And she says, development in the third world plays an important role in the context of peace and detente. Political changes in the poor countries can bring about a real or feared change of influence among the superpowers. One dramatic example is the situation in Central America. The roots of the insurgency are to be found in the general poverty created by centuries of oppression. When the villagers in El Salvador or Guatemala fight for social justice and the right of their families to survive, they act for their own just cause. But their fight is interpreted in the global East-West conflict and is used to serve the international combat between the superpowers. And so the villagers are labeled mercenaries of the Soviet Union, and consequently, they are the enemy. There's a double suffering that she's talking about here. She's talking about the very obvious suffering of these villagers. But did you hear the other one that she was alluding to? She said, political changes in the poor countries can bring about a real or feared change of influence among the superpowers. That's sort of an imagined suffering that I feel we often fall into. Their call for their little piece of the pie is seen by us as a threat. You know, the haves generally don't want to give up to the have-nots. And then we suffer. Think of the suffering that we would undergo if we had to pay what bananas really are worth in terms of toil and blood and sweat and lost land. And who of us would be willing to do that? We complain in the supermarket when the bananas go up 2 cents a pound. What if we couldn't have our coffee and our chocolate every day? So that we can have coffee, chocolate, and bananas, all these nice desserts. People in South and Central America barely get their daily bread. We perceive that as a terrible suffering, but we had to give that up. Is that real suffering or is that imagined suffering? So I was very struck by what Margareta Grapalanz said. Two other small sections I'd like to read you. There are a lot more of these sorts of things. But in the statements that the assembly adopted, you know, there are many statements about problems around the world, problems within the churches. One statement was on caring for God's endangered creation. And it says, the Seventh Assembly of the Lutheran World Federation expresses the LWF's concern about a major irreversible destruction of the environment through irresponsible exploitation of the world. And it believes that every person has an obligation as a creature of God to respect and care for the created world as one of God's gifts and as a presupposition for human life. And it goes on calling upon the LWF and all of its members to work with the World Council of Churches and other groups trying to see how we can go about caring for the environment better. Isn't there something also in the New Testament about the whole creation groaning in its bonds, waiting for the revelation of the children of God? Has it ever groaned as much as it does today? I read somewhere that there's at least one drop of oil now on every square foot of the ocean surface. I don't know if that's true or not, but it certainly brings a picture. I mean, does God suffer with the creation or not? I think sometimes we have difficulty with that image because in our tradition, we are so powerfully trained to think of God as being separate from the creation. God is out there, the creation is over here. And if we use up all the trees, well, God can bring in a new world anyway, as a certain interior secretary once said. Does God suffer when the earth is abused? Here's a statement on hunger, and this will strike a chord with many of you who've already spoken up today. Whereas at this very moment, according to reports of the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, 150 million people are affected by starvation in Africa. And whereas according to the annual reports of the UN International Children's Emergency Fund, that's UNICEF, 30 children under the age of 5 die of starvation or malnutrition every minute somewhere in the third world. Think of that. 30 a minute under 5. And there's a couple more whereases. And then, of course, it calls upon LWF members to do various things, but this one is the kicker for me. The Assembly requests all LWF member churches to appeal to their governments to redirect 1% of their military budget for assistance for those now afflicted by drought, and then to inform the LWF General Secretary of what actions they've taken in this regard. And that might bring some suffering on us if we did that. We might be called unpatriotic. 1% is a big slice when you have the kind of enormous military budget that we have. Well, I put this report before you because as I was reading through it, I was struck at the amount of suffering in these pages and the voices of suffering humanity that were heard at our LWF assembly in Budapest last year. Someone back here, please.
I was wondering how much, or the thought occurred to me, how much God must be suffering in our attempted solutions to the problem. The solutions that are short range, let's get through this 2 years, rather than the long range solution of all of us working in the same environment.
Yeah. And it's hard to know what to do, isn't it?
Yeah, the seeing the problem, seeing certain types of solutions. Yeah. But not being able to avail us to the solution, how we should handle the situation.
Yeah. And how often we then use that as an excuse to do nothing. Yeah. Well, it's so difficult to figure out the solution.
Yeah.
You know, Elmer Witt at Eucharist last night was saying, well, you know, there's no answer, and Christ is it. And therefore, we're free to risk some solutions anyway, to try. One common scriptural theme, of course, if we can switch just a little bit of our direction, because we have only about 10 minutes left in the section, is of course that God hears and helps those who suffer. In the scriptures, for example, you know, the one theme is very often women who can't have children, because that was very important for their self-identity in that society, and how God hears their prayers and sends children. We have, for example, a Sarah, or Samuel's mother, or Elizabeth, the wife of Zechariah, or there's a psalm about how God makes the mother who has no children now more happy than others, that sort of a thing. Or, you know, the major picture of God helping sufferers in the Old Testament is the Exodus. He says, I've heard these cries of oppression, I've heard your prayers, and I've come down to help you. I'm going to do something about it. And that is the overwhelming picture that Israel always retains of its God, the one who steps in as liberator in situation of oppression. And of course, Christians have as their major image of God, God suffering also. And at this village this summer, it's powerfully imaged for us in the cross that we have in Village Center, sent to us as a gift from people who have been kicked out of their own homeland and had to seek refuge in Mexico. The image of God suffering. So God is not only one who suffers, God also hears. And so you have this double image. And somehow or other, the God is pictured as being apart from the suffering and able to do something about it. And at the same time, in a rather overwhelming paradox, it's one, for example, that Muslims can't live with. They can never understand this about Christians. How the God who can help the sufferer should also somehow also, you know, be in the suffering and be suffering along. Muslims have a hard time with that. People in some other religious groups don't have as much trouble. They have similar pictures, but Muslims can never quite get that together.
Now, when you say that this, you're touching upon the uniqueness of the whole, use the word biblical revelation, you're dealing with a God who suffers, or a God who identifies with suffering.
Yes.
Which really sets apart the whole biblical story from other religious traditions.
From some other religious traditions.
Usually God suffered.
Mm-hmm.
Usually beyond suffering. Even the Eastern religions, God don't suffer. They're beyond suffering. And
well, for example, in the Buddhist tradition, you see, you have this. Because you have all the bodhisattvas. These are the ones who have reached full enlightenment. And they are beyond suffering now. And there's this wonderful story, you know, they're like those who have struggled and struggled in all the morass with the rest of us, and they now have reached the top of the wall, and here is paradise, nirvana, whatever you want to call it, on the other side. But before they go over, they glance back and see suffering humanity. And out of an act of ultimate compassion, they decide not to enter nirvana. And they remain with us in our suffering. So there is a very powerful tradition of that in Buddhism. Muslims have a hard time with this. Muslims can never quite put that together because for them, you know, God is so unique and so beyond, and they cannot conceive of God being in the suffering. If God is really to help, the God must be apart from the suffering. But I'd say some of the Buddhist traditions sort of share the Christian insight that the God comes and actually suffers along. And that's the daring confession of the followers of Jesus of Nazareth, isn't it? That God was present in the sufferings of Jesus. That actually is a theme that's powerful in the Old Testament, and I think Christians often overlook it. We talked last week about Abraham Heschel's idea of the pathos of God, and we looked at a couple of verses in the prophetic literature where God responds to Israel like a parent suffering over a child here that's going the wrong way. Or how God responds to Israel like a spouse who's been deserted by the other spouse. And the picture of the suffering heart of God, or as Dick mentioned this morning, you know, God suffers in God's own bowels, as it were. Or in God's own womb, if you want to use that feminine image. Well, as we go on this week and deal with Phyllis Trible's book, Texts of Terror, we're going to look at four individual women in the Old Testament who image God's suffering. And I hope to use them to raise our consciousness for some of the special suffering that women have borne. If you read Trible's introductory chapter, it's entitled, On Telling Sad Stories. She says that in telling their stories again, she wants us to memorialize these women, to sort of lift them up and affirm their sufferings. And she doesn't want us to feel easy answers too soon. She wants us to suffer along with them, and perhaps in that way, I would suggest, we might be enabled better to bear our own sufferings more courageously, and perhaps to enter into and help bring healing to the sufferings of others, even in lives and stories where, as Phyllis says, there is no immediate happy ending. I think that one of the things we sometimes do as we're growing, and particularly this is my own feeling, when we raise our children, is sometimes we give them the full message too soon. You know, we want them to know the whole Christian message, and we especially want to get them to salvation very quickly. And yet I wonder whether that's really real. If you get to salvation too quickly, do you ever really enter into the solidarity of God's suffering? And so these are, she calls these texts of terror, because they're stories about women being terrorized and about some of the particular suffering that they have to bear. And one woman is an outcast, two women are raped, one is actually put to death as an offering to God by her father. Tribble also uses an interesting picture as what she feels she did when she wrote the book, and she invites readers to enter into it. And I suspect she does this purposely at the beginning, because all those who are of faint heart, she wants to weed out before she even gets started. And she says, what informed me as I was working through these stories was that other powerful story from Genesis of Jacob when he wrestled with a divine being all night at the Wadi Jabbok. And he didn't know whether that being was friendly or unfriendly, whether it was a god or a demon, but he hung on in hopes that he would get the blessing. He was told that he had a blessing. But what a blessing! The blessing was that he remained alive with a limp. And the blessing was that his name was changed to Israel, which means God struggles. That's a hard word. And it carries a hope, because it isn't fulfilled. He walked away limping. Can we be healed even while we're limping?